Well, I do thank those of you that could come out today. We know that, of course, many people are traveling. Didn't Suzanne do a good job? I'll see if I can do as well. And it certainly was an interesting weekend and certainly more to come. By the way, I will be speaking this week up at the Kennicott Institute in Branson. That is something that they do every year. They have about 60 students that are college graduates, and so that'll be an opportunity to be up there, but I'll have to do it without Suzanne this time. So I'll be on radio a little bit, but also be doing that. So let's, if we can, turn, if you would, with me to John chapter 9, and we're going to continue our series, as we oftentimes do here, in the Gospel of John, and we'll be looking at today, Jesus is the one who heals. And as always, for those of you that are visitors, we actually have kind of an application at the end. And also for those of you that are visitors, by now, the PDF of this presentation should be up. About 10 minutes to 11, I noticed something flash, and it was Parker saying, I'm going to pull over the side of the road and upload the PDF. So I don't know if he's coming back from Galveston or whatever, but anyway, it should be up there. He just alerted me that just 20 minutes ago, he was in the process of getting it up there. And I'm being told right now, it's up there, so you can follow along. So isn't that fun? We'll have to thank Parker for being willing to interrupt his trip to do that. We're going to look today at Jesus healing a blind man, but interestingly enough, instead of that leading to belief, a phenomenal miracle, it leads to skepticism, it leads to criticism, and even some doubt. Except for the man that was healed, because we see him actually come to faith. The Jewish leaders are, of course, in disbelief that a man blind before he was actually blind before he encountered Jesus, and so they refuse to believe that anything that Jesus does is from God. And so we're going to see that, and Jesus uses this to talk about the fact that he is the light of the world. What I thought I would do for just a minute before we watch our little video, which I always like to do, is talk about this idea of spiritual blindness. And some of this comes from a new book that has just come out. This last week I had a chance to interview David Barton, who with George Barna has written a book called U-Turn. Now, the first part of the book goes through almost mind-numbing set of statistics, so I only picked out just a very few. But the book talks about not only our heritage, but where our country is going and the need for us to make a U-turn. But, you know, on the positive side, we can say that still, when you do a survey, about 86% of adults in America still believe in some concept of God. However, when you begin to ask what they mean by that, for example, only about 6 out of 10, 62% believe in an all-knowing, all-powerful creator of the universe who still rules the world today. So you can see that lots of times when we're involved in witnessing, somebody says, well, I believe in God. Sometimes you need to say, well, what kind of view of God do you have? And interestingly enough, one of the fastest growing statistics in America today, especially among young people, is that about 25% of young adults and adults generally label themselves as individuals who say, I don't know if God exists, or I know God does not exist. What David Barton referred to as the nuns, none of the above, you know, that's kind of their check mark. So those are some of those beliefs. And so again, when we talk today about spiritual blindness, and we see the spiritual blindness in the Pharisees, let's not become Pharisees ourselves. Let's recognize that we live in a world with a lot of spiritual blindness. Another couple of illustrations here that I can give you. We find that, again, a large majority of individuals believe that Jesus was a historic person. I'm still surprised that's 82%. You know, if it were closer to 96%, I think I'd feel a little better. So that means a lot of people still don't know if he really existed. But fewer people, that is 2 out of 3, believe that Jesus was the Son of God. So, again, a recognition of spiritual blindness. And interestingly enough, when you ask the questions, and these are a series of questions in the Barna survey, we use this, matter of fact, in the probe survey that we did with George Barna. This was another one that David Barton did with George Barna. They find that about 23% believe that the Bible is the Word of God, has no errors, can be taken literally. Those are actually 3 questions. But when you get down there, you recognize again that people do not hold the Bible in the same esteem and with the same value as before. So again, you can see where the root of that spiritual blindness is. If you don't believe that this is the Word of God, and if you don't believe that it is an authoritative source, you can see why we have some of the views that we have today. And I could go through, but I won't, because of the interest of time, all the series of various behaviors which at least a majority of Americans thought were moral. You know, it's one thing to say sex outside of marriage is something that happens. Another thing to say sex outside of marriage is moral. It's one thing to say that drug abuse is something that just happens in our society. It's another thing to say, as a majority do, that, you know, drug abuse can be moral. And you go through this long list. It's one thing to say, well, you know, maybe some people of the same sex want to get married, but you get a very high percentage saying that it's moral. And you go through this long list and you go, we're in some real trouble, and spiritual blindness is kind of what is affecting us today. So I use that as a background to recognize that we look at the spiritual blindness today of a blind man seeing, but then other people that can see but are spiritually blind. We see that this is what Jesus is really speaking about. And so I thought I would pull just a clip from the visual Bible, because it's a great opportunity for us to see what we are going to read in John 9. So let's see if we can learn a little bit more about Jesus.
As Jesus was walking along, he saw a man who had been born blind.
Teacher, who sinned caused him to be born blind? Was it his own or his parents' sin?
His blindness has nothing to do with his sins or his parents' sins. He is blind so that God's power might be seen at work in him. As long as it is day, we must keep on doing the work of him who sent me. Night is coming, when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light for the world.
After he said this, Jesus spat on the ground and made some mud with the spittle. He rubbed the mud on the man's eyes.
Go and wash your face in the pool of Siloam.
This name means sent. Then, and the people who had seen him begging before this asked, isn't this the man who used to sit and beg?
He's the one.
No, he isn't. He just looks like him. I am the man. How is it that you can now see?
The man called Jesus made some mud, rubbed it on my eyes, and told me to go to Siloam and wash my face. So I went, and as soon as I washed, I could see.
Where is he?
I don't know.
Then they took to the Pharisees the man who had been blind. The day that Jesus made the mud and cured him of his blindness was a Sabbath. The Pharisees then asked the man again how he had received his sight.
He put some mud on my eyes. I washed my face, and now I can see.
A man who did this cannot be from God, for he does not obey the Sabbath law. How could a man who is a sinner perform such miracles as these?
And there was division among them.
You say he cured you of your blindness.
Well, what do you say about him?
He is a prophet.
The Jewish authorities, however, were not willing to believe that he had been blind and could now see until they called his parents.
Is this your son? You say that he was born blind. How is it then that he can now see?
We know that he is our son, and we know that he was born blind. But we don't know how it is that he is now able to see, nor do we know who cured him of his blindness.
Ask him. He is old enough and he can answer for himself.
His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jewish authorities, who had already agreed that anyone who said he believed that Jesus was the Messiah would be expelled from the synagogue. That is why his parents said, "He is old enough, ask him." A second time, they called back the man who had been born blind.
Promise before God that you will tell the truth. We know that this man who cured you is a sinner.
I do not know if he is a sinner or not. One thing I do know. I was blind. And now I see.
What did he do to you? How did he cure you of your blindness?
I have already told you and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Maybe you too would like to be his disciples.
They insulted him and said,
"You are that fellow's disciple. But we are Moses' disciples. We know that God spoke to Moses. As for that fellow, however, we do not even know where he comes from."
What a strange thing that is. You do not know where he comes from, but he cured me of my blindness. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He does listen to people who respect him and do what he wants them to do. Since the beginning of the world, nobody has ever heard of anyone giving sight to a person born blind. Unless this man came from God, he would not be able to do a thing.
You were born and brought up in sin. And you are trying to teach us.
And they expelled him from the synagogue. Jesus heard what had happened. He found the man.
Do you believe in the Son of Man?
Tell me who he is, sir, so that I can believe in him.
You have already seen him. And he is the one who is talking with you now.
I believe, Lord.
And he knelt down before Jesus.
I came to this world to judge, so that the blind should see, and those who see should become blind.
Some Pharisees who were there with him heard him say this and asked him,
"Surely you don't mean that we are blind too?"
If you were blind, then you would not be guilty. But since you claim that you can see, this means that you are still guilty.
Quite a bit there, but I thought I would use that to really begin to unpack all of that. Turn with me, if you would, to John chapter 9. We're going to look at that in a little more detail. This has a real special meaning to me because when I actually had a chance to do this last time, I was actually on the southern steps of the temple in Israel. So it is kind of meaningful to me as well. But again, we see here in chapter 9, verse 1, that as he passed by, we see that Jesus indeed is meeting this man. And it is interesting that he sees the blind man. Then the disciples ask again, "Who sinned, this man or his parents?" And of course, Jesus then says, verse 3, "It is not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I'm in the world, I am the light of the world." And so here, he begins to use this as an opportunity to teach. And here, I think it is interesting that both the disciples and we saw here, the Pharisees assume that if somebody is blind, that they have sinned. A little bit later, I'm going to talk about disability. disabilities, and I love the fact that our church reaches out to those with disabilities. But here, look at this disability that he has here. And Jesus takes the question, but then shows that this is an opportunity for God to work. And we, as we're going to see at the very end here, fit very much to the message that Pastor Graham gave last week on Romans 8:28, because here, this sinfulness is used in a way to show God's glory. You can think of that in terms of the cross. The various Pharisees, Roman authorities meant it for evil, but God used it for good. And we see this also in this particular miracle. Notice that the Pharisees at one point say, you know, no one has ever cured blindness. And this may surprise even Bible scholars, because if you go through all the stories in the Old Testament, there is no story in the Old Testament that deals with giving sight to the blind. Of all the miracles, and we have quite a few, Elijah, we have no example of, in the Old Testament, of anybody regaining their sight who was born blind. We only have one example outside of the Gospels, even in the New Testament, of somebody who lost their sight who regains it, and that's the Saul of Tarsus. So it's interesting. But if you go back and count the miracles, and there are whole books written on the miracles of Jesus, you find that he does more miracles having to do with sight than anything else. And so the greatest miracle that you see here, the most frequent miracle, probably a better way to say it, is one that happens here with this man who was born blind. Verse 4, though, interestingly enough, Jesus says something else, and that is, he says that while it is day, night is coming. What does he mean by that? Well, probably refers to the difficult days ahead on Passion Week. Recognize again, as we pointed out before, this happens in the Feast of Tabernacles, which we've just had this year, and it's what precedes the Feast of Passover. And so this is happening about 6 months before the Passion Week. And so the idea is that we must work now before that takes place. And I think an obvious implication is that sometimes we recognize the days are evil, and so it's important for, I think, us as believers to work as well. I might call your attention to a great hymn by Anne Louise Walker. Work for the night is coming. Work through the morning hours. Work while the dew is sparkling. Work mid springing flowers. Work when the day grows brighter. Work in the glowing sun. Work for the night is coming when man's work is done. This week was just a reminder again that there are only so many days left for each one of us. As Suzanne likes to sometimes say, we're all terminal. There's only so much time left for us to do what we need to do. And so certainly here, a reminder that even here, in the midst of performing this miracle, Jesus uses that to remind his disciples there's only a limited amount of time. And as we heard Jarrett speak this morning, the last letter by Paul, as he is kind of finishing the race, recognizing his time was limited as well. So then we see in verses 6 and 7 where he spits on the ground. Here he pulls up the dirt in the picture, but he actually spits on the ground, makes mud, and then anoints the man's eyes with that mud. And then he tells them him to actually go and to wash in the pool of Siloam, or which is oftentimes referred to as sent. That's kind of interesting. You know, here's a man who's blind, Jesus talking to him, and also the next thing he hears is... You know, you got to wonder what's kind of going through his mind. You know, I love how he touches him and he backs off and then he puts his hand on his shoulder. I mean, there's kind of an interesting idea. Why does Jesus spit? We'll talk about mud in just a minute. But, you know, what is that all about? And there's some people that think that Jesus is really going out of his way to really drive the Pharisees nuts. Because not only is he performing this miracle on the Sabbath, but interestingly enough, it shows a division in the rabbis, and I did not know that until I read this week, that some of the rabbis actually believe that the saliva of a firstborn had healing properties. By the way, I think that's a wives' tale. Don't try that on your children or anything else. But nevertheless, but then because saliva came to be associated, especially in the pagan areas, the Canaanites and others, with pagan rituals, most of the other rabbis condemned saliva. But whether you were in one camp of the rabbis or the other camp of the rabbis, one thing that all the Jews would agree with at the time was that saliva is one of the body fluids. woods, it would make you ceremonially unclean, according to the standards of that day. Now, you've got to understand where this is taking place. It's on the southern steps of the temple. And in the southern steps, there's also what's called a mikvah. I'll talk more about that in just a minute, which was used to make sure that you were ceremonially clean. And Jesus is standing right here where people are trying to make themselves ceremonially clean before they go into the temple. And he does something that would make most people what? Ceremonially unclean. And that brings us to some of the pictures here. When I was in Israel, we were actually on those steps. And the steps on the right-hand side there, on the left part of that picture, are reconstructed, but the other steps are the actual ones that they've uncovered. These are the steps that Peter went up. These are the steps that Peter actually preached on the day of Pentecost. These were the steps that Jesus and Andrew and all of them went up. These are the steps, no doubt, that Paul went up. These are the steps that Stephen went up. These are the various steps. And on the left-hand side kind of shows you a reconstruction from a model of what that must have looked like as they enter into those two gates. But in this particular area, you have on the left hand here, those are some of the stones. I had to take some pictures of the stones where Jesus no doubt probably walked and where the disciples walked. But next to it, you have what's called a mikvah. Now, unless you're Jewish, you go, what's a mikvah? Well, it's kind of like a small little pool, and you walk down one side of it into the water, and then as you walk up the other side, you are considered to be ceremonially clean. Now, do you see the picture? Jesus is right there while Jews are making themselves ceremonially clean so that they can go into the temple and offer their sacrifice, and right there is a blind man. He spits in the dirt and puts it in his eyes. By the way, the uncovering of the mikveh answered another question that has been a challenge to the gospel. You remember in the book of Acts, when Peter preaches, it tells us that how many? Thousands of people became Christians and they were baptized. Now, one of the skeptics, many of the skeptics of the Bible said, how did you baptize thousands of people? Because he's standing on the steps of the temple when he's preaching on the day of Pentecost. There's no river in Jerusalem. The river, Jordan River, is a long way away. So how in the world could you have possibly baptized thousands of people on the day of Pentecost? Well, now that they've uncovered all these, there are these mikvahs all over the place, and it's most likely that on the day of Pentecost, they were all baptized in the places that the Jews had used to ceremonially clean themselves. So it answers one of the great criticisms of the Bible. Again, archaeology is the friend of the Bible. But I digress. Now let's go down the rest of this part. Because now, as we saw in the picture here, verses 8 and following, the neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, is not this the man who used to sit and beg? And some said, it is he. And others said, no, but he is like him. And he said, no, I am the man. And then he tells a story about his eyes were open. And so we see that so often when a miracle takes place, we always think, God, if you could just perform a miracle today, people would believe. Let's do a miracle on television, you know, and we could just reach the whole world for Christ. And here, there are a lot of people that are pretty doubtful. And they question whether or not this is the man. They talk about themselves. But it's interesting how he describes it. It's very obvious he doesn't know much about Jesus. He just simply says that this was done by what? The man called Jesus. I want to show that in just a minute because his faith begins to grow through this process. But nevertheless, we can see now, verse 13 and following, that they then now take him to the Pharisees as he was blind. The Pharisees ask him how it took place. And finally, verse 16, some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. We can see, as we've seen over the last couple of weeks, that every time Jesus breaks the Sabbath, and he seems to go out of his way to do so, it is a very significant issue. It is a roadblock. It is a stumbling block. And they're so spiritually blind and they're so fixated about the Sabbath, they can't even see the miracle nor what Jesus is actually teaching them. And so, of course, they question whether this man is indeed from God because, after all, he is healed on the Sabbath. And interestingly enough, note the progression now of this man who was born blind. Because in verse 11, he refers to him, as we just saw, the man called Jesus. Then look at verse 17. At this point there, then we saw that in the video, he now calls calls Jesus a prophet. Well, that's a pretty significant move from the man called Jesus to now he's a prophet. As I'm going to point out in just a minute, that was a very significant accolade from him. Then verse 27, go all the way down here. Then one that you might follow him as disciples. We see that wasn't exactly a way to win friends and influence your enemies, because indeed the Pharisees got very upset about that. And then verse 33, as we'll see in just a minute, he says this man is from God. And then finally in verse 38, as we saw on the video, he is worship. So we see, if you will, the spiritual progression. That's helpful in terms of evangelism. Sometimes, you know, we kind of think that what we need to do is preach the gospel, and then we have an altar call and they all come forward. And that happens sometimes. There's no doubt about that. You know, there are times when, to use a football analogy, you throw the Hail Mary and they score. But most of evangelism is sort of a 5-yard game. You know, and there's a sense in which you can see the spiritual progression in this individual as he goes from the man called Jesus to the man who's a prophet, to the point in which he's willing to worship him. And interestingly enough, it shows us a little bit more about that claim to be a prophet, because remind yourself again that it had been 400 years since there had been a prophet in the land, and now John the Baptist was the first prophet that they had seen in 400 years. Now we see this man born blind, who is now healed, referring to Jesus as a prophet. But he was not only a prophet, but somebody who was traveling all through Israel healing those individuals. Once again, though, we see the issue of the Sabbath. That is why they persecuted Jesus. And if you're taking some notes, you might put down John 5:16 to remind yourself that John clearly points out that one of the reasons they wanted to put him to death was not necessarily always initially because he claimed to be God, although next week we're going to see a very direct and specific claim to be God that causes them to all reach for rocks once again. But what started all of this was simply the fact that Jesus healed on the Sabbath, and he went out of his way sometimes to do so. So the Jewish leaders question his parents, but we see, and John helps us understand in verse 22, why they did not give a specific answer, because they did not want to actually get removed from the synagogue, to be removed from the temple. Because in that day, excommunication had a very heavy price. It affected your finances, because once you were excommunicated, no Jew would buy from you. When we were in Israel recently, we actually had lunch one day with some Armenians that live in the Muslim quarter, and none of the Muslims will buy anything from them, and they'll tell everybody else not to buy anything from them. And so if it weren't for the generosity of some of the Christians that would come and buy from them, they would not exist. And you see the same kind of thing. If you are Jewish and you are not part of the synagogue, you're in a lot of trouble, because you lose your finances, you lose your fellowship, you lose your continuity with the religious community. And so the parents are very careful not to say anything that caused the Jewish leaders to excommunicate them. So then we see the final kind of illustration here. We have, first of all, the testimony of the man, then the sort of non-testimony of the parents, and then we come back to this second testimony of the man. And I think it shows a little bit more that this didn't all happen perhaps within a 24-hour period. It might have happened over a few days. But nevertheless, here is the emphasis once again on the fact that, let's start in verse 24. So the second time they called the man who had been blind and said to him, "Give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner." And so they set up the argument by saying, look, up until now you maybe haven't understood how significant what this claim is, so let's give glory to God and let's put Jesus aside. So what they're trying to do is, let's separate Jesus from God. And John does this in a way to sort of get everybody smiling a little bit, at least internally, because that's what Jesus has for these last couple of chapters. Chapters 7, 8, and 9, we'll see this next week in chapter 10, is really trying to establish that he and God are one and the same. But here, they're trying to separate those. And again, we see in verse 32, their unwillingness to believe that this was a miracle, because after all, look what they say, "Never since the world began has it been heard that any anyone open the eyes of a man born blind? And this brings us back to the fact that there is no record of a person born blind in the Old Testament who is ever able to see. And so they cannot bring themselves to acknowledge the phenomenal aspect of this miracle. So history is their guide, tradition is their guide, and they reject the claims of Jesus. I love this. At this point now, he is in the midst of being sort of put on the hot seat. It's a little bit like Martin Luther before the Diet of Worms, or it could be many of the Protestant Reformation, those who stood in judgment. And now he finds himself in a situation in judgment for the Pharisees, and he gives a simple testimony. I was blind, and now I see. That was really all the testimony he could give at the time, and it's why, and the reasons why I say, you know, you don't have to know a lot to actually go out and share your faith. If nothing else, tell your story. I once was lost, and now I'm saved. You know, I once was blind, and now I see. And so we see that they persecute him in two ways. First of all, they hurl insults at him. Here it talks about the fact that you were born in utter sin. Why do they say that? Well, because you're blind, it must be either the sin of your parents or yours, perhaps both. So they hurl insults at him, and they also hurl him out of the temple. They excommunicate him. And so here, you could have ended the story. But as you see, the story continues on, because now, verse 35, Jesus heard that they cast him out, and having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" If you think about it, most of the miracles that Jesus did are ones where he does the miracle and then they run off. As a matter of fact, some of the miracles, you know, nine of them run off and only one even comes back to say thank you. Remember that one? But in this case, it's not a drive-by miracle, because he now uses this as an opportunity to actually confront that individual, who no doubt at this point is probably very sad. He has now paid a heavy price for his belief that Jesus is a prophet. And now we see that he becomes a believer. And this, as far as we can tell, is the first time Jesus offers himself as a personal object of faith. That is, you can believe in me. And I think I also love this idea that Jesus looked for the man rather than the man looked for Jesus. You know, lots of times we say that we were lost, you know, and now I was found. That's probably true. But sometimes we say, I found Jesus, as if Jesus was lost. You know, how we sometimes turn the phrase. No, Jesus was never lost. We were lost. But I love what Chris Austin put it in one of his commentaries. The Jews cast him out of the temple, and the Lord of the temple found him. And so we now see a believer in Jesus, and he asks the very foundational question, do you believe in the Son of Man? And he, once he understands who it is, says, Lord, I believe. And I love it in the video where they show him bending down. And at this point, the Pharisees are completely overwhelmed by the fact that now there is an individual that is worshiping Jesus. And so they ask, of course, the fundamental questions instead. And those, of course, when he challenges this, those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. I think it's an illustration that those who recognize their spiritual blindness will be given an opportunity to see, but those who deny that will be blind. And of course, it ends with the Pharisee asking the question, are we also blind? And Jesus says, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say we see, your guilt remains. And so it kind of ends with that very challenging presentation. Next week, we'll continue on in chapter 10. And as we do so, we'll see that Jesus makes so many more dramatic claims to deity that it was impossible for anybody to miss the message. And already we've shown many, many times where Jesus has claimed to be God. But I thought I would try to answer a couple of questions. And the first one that always comes up is, why mud, really? You know, why does he spit in the ground and use mud? And some believed, perhaps, that Jesus was catering to the views of the day. There were some that believed that mud, or even, as we pointed out, saliva might have a medicinal value. Some have pointed out, perhaps, that clay is oftentimes described as creation. Here, the creator of the universe, who created man out of dust, uses dust now to heal him. Those are possible answers, but I think there's a simpler one. And I think this man needed something physical before he could actually make a spiritual commitment. And the example I use there is Gideon and the fleece. police. Did an interview recently with Johnny Moore, who used to be at Liberty University, and now he's actually working out in Hollywood with a lot of these Christian films. But he was talking about in his book about how we know the will of God, and sometimes we want a fleece. By the way, I don't think a fleece is a real good idea. If you're trying to find God's will, don't just open up your Bible randomly. You've heard all the jokes about, you know, the guy that opens it up and it says, Judas went out and hung himself. Oh, okay, well, I got to, you know, flip around and find another one. He finds another verse that says, go and do likewise. You know, I mean, those are not good ways to find God's will, you know, and neither is a fleece. People always say, well, put out a fleece and then, you know, that will be the way and God will show me. Well, actually, that's sort of showing your unbelief. But here's a man that had never met Jesus. So Jesus, I think, maybe uses a physical symbol, that is mud on his eyelids, to once again help him see something more significant. And he once again approaches him and now moves from physical healing to spiritual healing. So anyway, that's at least one idea that maybe he used this to really get this man's attention, because there are times he was able to heal just from a spoken word. There wasn't anything medicinal value in the mud. Why the Sabbath, interestingly enough? Well, Jesus on more than one occasion has done this, and Matthew answers a question that John pretty much ignores, and that is because Jesus said, I am the Lord of the Sabbath. And if you think about it, the Sabbath is for what? Rest. Why did God create in 6 days and rest on the seventh day? Was God worn out after 6 days of that? I don't think so. But he established a pattern, 6 days of work and 1 day of rest. And rest is a time in which we get healed. And there you begin to see the irony. Because if in a possible idea, as I put up here in the notes, what day could be better for God, the Son of God, than to actually find a broken man and heal him on a day in which we are supposed to be what? Healed. It would give him and his parents also the rest from the struggles of blindness. Imagine how difficult it is, and I love how that shows him using a stick, just trying to even find his way to the Pool of Siloam. I mean, I believe that this miracle most likely started on the temple steps. He didn't tell him to go to the mikveh and wash, because the Jews would have probably killed him if he did. So he has to walk a little bit further, you know, finding his way, and eventually finds his way, which is the closest pool. That's why we know it was by the southern steps. Otherwise, he'd be at the Pool of Bethesda. And so he goes there and heals himself at the pool. But again, this was a reminder then that he will no longer have to find his way. He actually, you know, they show him even wanting to get something to eat, you know, and now he can feed himself. Now he can take care of himself. His parents, no doubt, had the burden of having a child with a disability. And of course, now we see the healing. Which brings me to my final comments here about disabilities. This and many other passages would be a good time to talk about that. And again, I applaud this church for really addressing this issue of disabilities and really providing opportunities for those who have disabilities, providing opportunities for parents who have children with special needs. And I found a few statistics that will help you understand that sometimes we're so used to being around healthy people. I mean, when you go to the mall, you're around healthy people. When you get on an airplane, you're around healthy people. You know, even when you come to church, you're usually around healthy people. But basically, nearly 20% of U.S. citizens live with some form of disability. Isn't that amazing? That's a lot. Now, some of us in this room could actually say we have a disability of some sort. And they come in all sorts of forms. This man, of course, had one that was congenital from birth, you know, various genetic diseases and things like that. You have, you know, infectious diseases, accidents because of disabilities. And since we're an older Sunday school class, just the degenerative effects of old age, right? You know, put up all the Christmas lights yesterday, and I'm surprised I don't hurt more, but I do hurt a little bit, less than I would have in my 30s, okay? You know, so we all feel those effects. Climbing the stairs, sometimes say, maybe I'll take the elevator this time, you know? All sorts of things are about that. And so it seems to me that we as Christians really need to face issues like autism, Down syndrome, spina bifida, dementia, Alzheimer's. I mean, it seems to me that we should have care about that. And frankly, the Bible does not shy away from topics of suffering and sorrow. It's filled with all sorts of biblical principles that shed light on suffering and those kinds of things. John 9:1, look at this again. Here we says that Jesus saw him as he passed by. And most importantly, the disciples saw that he saw the blind man. So Jesus didn't walk by him and ignore him. Jesus saw him. And I put up there, it's not exactly like Jesus was like, remember the priest or the Levi that walked on the other side of the road to Jericho and passed by the other side. Jesus saw this man, the disciples saw him, and of course that leads to the next question, because then they ask the question, well, who sinned? If you think about that, wasn't the most compassionate thing, right? You know, here this man is blind. He's probably within earshot. And so they ask Jesus, who sinned? Did he sin or did his parents sin? Which reminds me of some of the lack of compassionate things sometimes we say around people with disabilities. And if you've ever had a child or a grandchild and somebody with a disability walks in the room, you know what you're going to have to deal with, right? But some adults aren't any better in terms of some of the wrong things they say. And here we see that Jesus really establishes a model. He patiently answers their questions, but at the same time he also changes their categories. This is not that he was sinned, but actually that God may show his glory. And then, of course, he points out that it wasn't his sin or the parents' sin. It's really, if you really want to answer the question biblically, it was the sin of the whole world. Romans 18 to 25 teaches that there would never be suffering if there had not been sin. I'm going to give you that verse in just a minute. And so, in a sense, because we have suffering, it's because we live in a sinful world. It causes us to long for heaven, as Suzanne just talked about. It causes us to long for the new heaven and the new earth, where there's no pain or suffering or grief or death. So a lack of healing, though, is not a lack of faith. This is, again, an answer to some of the health and wealth gospels that say, well, you know, if you just had enough faith, you wouldn't have this particular disease, whatever that is. If you just had enough faith, you would believe that God could heal them of that disability. And I put up a good example. Paul, as far as we can tell, he records at least three times, he may have done more than that, actually did pray that the thorn in his flesh would be healed. How did God answer that to Paul? The answer was no, each one of those times. And so finally, he concludes in 2 Corinthians, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. So God intended that his power in the weakness of Paul would be great. And here we, today, through Jared, heard how he finished the race with that thorn in his flesh that he carried with him all of his life. And so, if nothing else, it reminds us of the fact that we live in a world today that is groaning in travail. You might put down in your notes there Romans 8, 22 and 23, because here, Paul himself, writing about this sin, writing about suffering, he has reminded us of this very thing, and he says, we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for the adoption as sons and the redemption of our bodies. We live in a fallen world and we are fallen people. And we look forward to the day when we get a new body and live in a new heaven and a new earth. And that is the verses that precede the pastor's message last week, Pastor Graham, and that is the idea of Romans 8:28. But before we get there, let's just think of, again, how God sometimes even uses the suffering and the disabilities for his glory. I gave you a couple of verses in Isaiah 46, verse 10. God says, I will accomplish all my purpose. Even in this fallen world, even with sinful, frail individuals, I will accomplish my purpose. In the New Testament, we see Paul talking about in Ephesians that God works all things according to the counsel of his will, which is kind of a setup for Romans 8:28. And one more I thought I might put in there, the book of Hebrews, nothing else. Book of Hebrews is talking about finishing the race. Glad that Jared finished the turkey trot and the 8 miles, you know, and all of us need to finish that race. But here, a reminder by the writer of Hebrews, for the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. So we'll end with Romans 8:28, which is the passage that Pastor Graham preached on last week, because here, now, in verse 3 of John 9, it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. It is a great reference to Romans 8:28, for we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, and those who are called according to his purpose. As Pastor Graham mentioned last time, it says all things, not a few things, not some things, but all things, all pain, suffering, and sorrow can be used by God for good. Doesn't mean the suffering and the pain are good, but it does mean that God can orchestrate all of that pain and bring it together for good. So that's the end of John chapter 9, but it also connects very much to the passage last week from Pastor Graham on Romans 8:28. It's been a great Thanksgiving weekend. Brad, why don't you close us in prayer?